Garden, with skin worn and gray as baked leather, showed a mouthful of crooked yellow teeth. A bald-headed man with bright, dangerous eyes offered a nod. Towering in the back was K2SO. Emerging at the fore came Cassian, chin high and back straight. He looked like he was ready to arrest her. "They were never going to believe you," Cassian said. "Not the council. Not today."
"I appreciate the support," she said. Her voice was frigid, her hands balled into fists. She was surprised how little she wanted this fight. She positioned herself between Bodhi and Cassian. After what the pilot and the Guardians had said, she was ready to do what was necessary to save them from the Alliance's goons.
"But I do," Cassian said. "I believe you." Her eyes flickered from Cassian to the soldiers. They were armed, but their postures were relaxed. Their weapons were down. A few even looked amused. "We'd like to volunteer," Cassian said. She didn't trust him. She didn't trust anything the galaxy could throw at her.
"Why?"
He smiled, and it died on his face.
"Some of us."
He hesitated, waited until Jin's gaze had met his.
"Most of us.
We've done terrible things on behalf of the rebellion." He spoke matter-of-factly, as if that were the most obvious truth in the world. "We're spies, saboteurs, assassins." Jin spared another glance at the soldiers. They were looking at her, one and all, as if awaiting judgment.
Was this a confession?
"Everything I did," Cassian said, "I did for the rebellion. And every time I walked away from something I wanted to forget, I told myself it was for a cause that I believed in, a cause that was worth it." He was almost stumbling over his sentences, forcing each out before he lost his nerve. Like a man wrenching a dislocated limb into place, one agonizing pull at a time. He went on.
"Without that, without a cause, we're lost. Everything we've done would have been for nothing. I couldn't face myself if I gave up now. None of us could."
"Don't do this," she wanted to say. "I can't give you absolution." Instead, she looked at the band he'd assembled and whispered with a sort of awe, "How did you find them?"
"It's been a busy day," he said, too dry to be devoid of humor. "I didn't need to see the whole briefing to know where it was going."
"I can't," she started. "I can't give you a cause." But she stepped back unsteadily and saw the ferocity, the need in Cassian's eyes mirrored in each of the soldiers. Whatever they'd seized on, it was no longer hers to give. She could no more refuse them than Cassian could have refused her after Jetta. She gave a curt nod. Someone in the group laughed.
"It won't be comfortable."
Bodhi was speaking behind her, looking between the soldiers and the tarmac where the cargo shuttle sat.
"It'll be a bit cramped, but we'll all fit. We could go."
"Okay,"
Cassian said. The emotion was gone from his voice, the confession done. He turned to the soldiers.
"Gear up! Grab anything that's not nailed down. We don't know what we'll find on Scarif, and we don't have long to prep. Go!"
The soldiers scattered, moving with purpose and surety. Bodhi and the Guardians joined them. Only Cassian and K2 remained. The droid looked down at her.
"Jin, I'll be there for you. Cassian said I had to."
She held back a laugh and looked to Cassian, the man who'd betrayed her, the man who'd admitted his guilt and decided to fight for her. He saw her staring and looked back at her quizzically. It wasn't how betrayals were supposed to go. And she remembered that while Cassian and Bodhi and the Guardians had seen her at her worst, she had seen them broken too. Bodhi, who had been tortured. The Guardians, who had lost their home. And Cassian, who had betrayed himself as easily as he had Jin. They all had their shame. With one another, at least, they had no vulnerabilities left. She thought of Wobani again, when she'd been alone among a thousand other prisoners.
"I'm not used to people sticking around when things go bad," she said by way of explanation.
She didn't know if Cassian really understood, but he said,
welcome home. And she knew she was. 20 minutes later, weighed down with weapons and duffels full of stolen gear, Jin and Cassian stepped out of the bright Yavin sunlight and into the cabin of the cargo shuttle. There were, Jin thought, even more faces than before, more scarred and sweaty and determined soldiers than she'd seen in the hangar. She realized with a pang that she likely wouldn't have time to learn their names before they arrived on Scarif, that soon they'd all be fighting for their lives together on a mission that was very likely to fail. Jin spotted Baze and Chirrut among the rebels. Chirrut's head was turned toward her, and he raised his staff like a salute or a toast. She remembered a saying from her days with Saul Guerrera, and spoke loud enough to be heard through the shuffling of the unit. May the Force be with us.
Cargo shuttle, we have a pushback request here. Read back, please. Request denied. You are not cleared for takeoff.
Bodhi winced at the comm and peered out the viewport at the tarmac. The flight droids had already tugged the shuttle away from the ziggurat hangar. That gave him room to initiate a vertical liftoff without worrying about igniting an inconveniently placed fuel tank.
Yes, yes, we are cleared, he said. Affirmative. Requesting a recheck.
It was a bad plan. It had all been a bad plan, of course, starting with Galen's message and ending with this unauthorized raid on Scarif. Now he was what? Defecting from his defection? If he survived, he'd be an Imperial traitor and a rebel mutineer. He'd be lucky to see the inside of a Yavin prison cell. He wondered if there was a Borg gullet on Yavin, too. He doubted it. He could take comfort in that.
I'm not seeing this request here,
the comm said. He thought about his passengers. Like him, they were going rogue, courting treason by defying the Alliance Council. They'd already pilfered enough Alliance weapons and gear to supply an army. And Bodhi had seen enough of the operation on Yavin to know equipment was in short supply. He wasn't sure if that made the personnel on base more or less likely to shoot the shuttle down. They'd want to recover the stolen gear, at least.
Are you sure everything's been processed?
Bodhi tried.
Someone should have authorized it by now.
He flipped a series of toggles and checked for warning lights. The mass-volume ratio was confusing the computer. A packed cargo pod normally meant 40 tons of ore, not a ship full of soldiers. But it wouldn't do any harm. He thought about all the bad bets he'd made in his life. The times he'd sunk everything on a long shot in order to win back what he'd lost, only to end up with nothing. Was that all he was doing now with Jin and the others? Doubling a bad bet? It didn't feel like that. There was none of the heady uncertainty, the mix of hope and despair. When he thought about what he was doing, he was almost calm.
What's your call sign?
The voice on the comm asked.
Yes, we have it. Just take off. Think, Bodhi. Give them something. Give them anything. If you give them something, they might not shoot.
Call sign, Rogue. Rogue One.
He transferred power to the thrusters,
felt the familiar wobble of a cargo shuttle taking off under his control. The officer on the other end of the comm was squawking at him.
Bodhi ignored it.
Rogue One, he declared. Pulling away.
At the age of 15, during the winter when she discovered smashball, romance, and her parents' profound imperfections, Mon Mothma had decided to devote her life to studying history, decided to turn her back on her family's political dynasty, and to spend her days in a cramped study reading 1,000-year-old diaries and letters and cargo manifests until her eyes burned. She would be detective, coroner, and philosopher all at once, examining means and motive and cause of death for entire civilizations. She hadn't become a historian, of course. By the next summer, Mon's moment of rebellion had been forgotten. Inertia and family pressures and a genuine love of governance
had returned her to the road of politics. She'd gone on to become a senator, far too young, she thought now, and scrabbled for votes and smiled and kept her head above water until she'd learned how to play the game for real. She'd campaigned for an end to one war and now, with even-handed hypocrisy, had built an army while trying to prevent another. She'd fled her home and a life to become the empire's most wanted woman and leader of a revolution. And she couldn't help but wonder what her 15-year-old self would have said about the Rebel Alliance, looking back on it from some distant future. For all their self-importance, the rebel leaders lacked the courage to transform their network of paramilitary cells and sympathetic politicians into more than a curiosity. Their inability to commit to a course of action ensured the empire's growth and the delegitimization of any future protest movements. Mon was accustomed to failure and self-judgment, but the thought still stung. The briefing room was nearly empty now. Voices worn from screaming had gone silent, and men and women who traveled across the galaxy to reach Yavin had retired to their ships or to more private consultations. There had been no consensus or formal vote, and Mon was grateful for that much. Given the tenor of the discussions, a swift decision could only have ended badly. Mon would not sleep tonight. She planned to spend the hours until the council reconvened in discussion with her peers and reaching out to allies who might salvage something from the situation. And while she wasn't yet sure what there was to salvage, she knew who to start with. Bail Organa, the former senator from Alderaan, seemed to be waiting for her near the briefing room door.
"You spoke well,"
he said as she approached, with funereal gravity. She smiled wanly and wondered if she looked as exhausted as he did. She had considered Bail a partner since the day they'd first discussed opposing Palpatine's rise to power. In all the years since, throughout all the arguments over Bail's charitable interventions and her covert dealings, she couldn't remember the lines in his face ever seeming so deep. "Despite what the others say, war is inevitable," she mused with a sigh. "Senator Pamlo has noble instincts, but she's wrong. If the Empire used the weapon at Jeddah, it will use it again. We can't prevent these genocides, but only resist them." Bail nodded, the motion so small it seemed like all he could muster.
"I agree. I must return to Alderaan to inform my people that there will be no peace."
Mon heard his pain at that admission and wondered what it would cost him.
"We will need every advantage," he added grimly.
It took Mon a moment to comprehend. Then she glanced to the closest other counselors and lowered her voice.
"Your friend," she said. "The Jedi."
Bail nodded again.
"He served me well during the Clone Wars and has lived in hiding since the Emperor's Purge."
He appeared to wait for Mon's verdict, but she had nothing to offer. At last he finished.
"Yes, I will send for him.
A Jedi, returning to fight against the Empire." It seemed an impossible thought.
So Mon focused on what was not. Captain Antilles' ship is docked with the Profundity for repairs, but it's nearly ready to go. The extraction should be simple. If it's not, his skills will be an asset.
"My assessment as well," Bail said.
"Whoever makes contact with the Jedi will have a terrible responsibility."
Mon knew who Bail had in mind. It was clear in the tired lines of his face, in the fear of a man who had never previously feared the Emperor's blackest vengeance. She was reluctant to doubt his decisions, but she needed to be certain.
"You'll need someone you can trust."
"I would trust her with my life," he said.
"You'll need to trust her with more,"
Mon thought, but he was already on his way out the door. And for all her reservations about Bail's agent, the girl was so young, no matter anything else, she could think of no one better. The matter was resolved then. Mon Mothma squeezed the exhaustion out of her eyes
and considered who to speak with next.
Chapter 15. Jin still lived in the cave in her mind, but it was larger now, so large it felt like it could contain worlds and armies, and so filled with light from above that she didn't feel trapped at all. She could only hope it wouldn't close on her again, not before the mission was over, not before she was through with Scarif. Jin was climbing into the cockpit as the shuttle lurched out of light speed. The azure mists of the hyperspace tunnel collapsed beyond the viewport, and stars streaked into visibility, fixed into place by real matter and real gravity. In the center of the stellar vista was a planet wrapped in deep blue oceans and speckled with clouds and rocky archipelagos. If not for the massive ring-shaped orbital station above the northern hemisphere, Scarif would have looked almost pristine.
Okay, Bodhi said. We're coming in.
He sat beside K2SO at the console, waving Jin between them with barely a backward glance. It was strange, Jin thought, to see him so confident, so comfortable.
What am I looking at? She asked, squinting at the ring.
She made out the specks of starships descending through its center, but then a shimmer outside the ring's edge caught her eye. The subtly distorting gleam of an energy field.
There's a planet-wide defensive shield with a single main entry gate, Bodhi said. The shuttle should be equipped with an access code that allows us through.
Assuming the Empire hasn't logged it as overdue. Or stolen, Bodhi said.
And if they have? Jin asked.
Then, Bodhi answered, they shut the gate and we're all annihilated in the cold, dark vacuum of space. Jin let out a huff of a half-laugh. She was starting to like the confident, comfortable, and cynical Bodhi.
Not me. I can survive in space.
Jin dug her fingers into the back of the cockpit seats and tried not to lean in. The shuttle veered gently in the direction of the gate, and the specks swiftly grew larger. The great wedge-shaped masses of twin star destroyers loomed like monstrous statues over the orbital station's portal, dwarfing the swarms of cargo shuttles and transports and TIE fighters. Jin tried to remember the last time she had seen so much Imperial activity in one place, and failed.
Okay, this is good, Bodhi said.
He glanced up at the Star Destroyers and then back to his scanners.
It's not normally this busy. I think this is good.
We're just one more ship. Nothing worth noticing.
Jin heard his confidence crack, then reassert itself.
Okay, here it goes.
The shuttle's thrusters rumbled and the deck plating trembled as course locked. The vessel accelerated through the vast distance separating itself from the gate. Bodhi worked the comm with one hand and said without a hitch, cargo shuttle SW0608 requesting a landing pad. Jin straightened off the cockpit chairs and backed away carefully. Confident, comfortable, and Imperial. She might have wondered what Bodhi had been like, what any of her companions had been like before the Death Star, if she hadn't been intent on not making a sound.
Cargo shuttle SW0608, you're not listed on the arrival schedule,
the voice on the comm said. The operator sounded vaguely puzzled. Bodhi had a ready reply.
Acknowledge gate control. We were rerouted from Edu Flight Station. Transmitting clearance code now.
Jin flinched as she heard a sound from the ladder into the cockpit. She glanced over to see Cassian, who seemed to sense the mood and paused in his climb. She knew enough about what the spy had been like before the Death Star. She wasn't sure if she'd forgiven him for it, or simply decided to abandon it, like a used-up blaster pack.
Transmitting,
K2 said. The console hummed softly and went silent as the dispatch finished. Cassian completed his climb, swift and hushed. Jin found her hand tangling in the string of her necklace, drawing the kyber crystal into starlight. Cassian had said, we've done terrible things. If this went wrong now,
If they failed before they'd even landed, Jin was sure the only unforgivable choice would be her own. She wrapped her fingers around the crystal. She imagined praying like she'd seen Chirrut pray. She nearly laughed, dangerously loud, and squelched the sound.
Cargo shuttle SW0608.
The voice in the comm had returned.
You are cleared for entry.
Jin dropped the crystal and squeezed her hand in a fist, almost shouting in triumph. She spun and was startled to see Cassian standing close to her. On instinct, riding the joy of the moment, she grabbed his arm and squeezed. He looked at her with a wry, curious smile. She dropped her hand and brushed past him. I'll tell the others, she said. The cave was getting brighter all the time. Jin was changing. It was evident in her fluid movements and her lucid stare. She no longer hunched her shoulders, no longer maintained the compact posture of a woman ready to absorb a hit before she hit back. She'd shed none of her intensity, but it came with what Cassian could only interpret as a confidence bordering on invincibility. She'd always struck him as a person unafraid to die. Now she seemed like someone who couldn't. He should have been terrified of following her into battle. He no longer understood her, could no longer locate her old need for answers, her desperate grasps at meaning. Yet he'd faced down her loathing during the return from Edu, walked a razor-fine edge before the briefing on Yavin, uncertain what would happen after. He'd told the story of his mission before the Council. Jin had told the story of hers, and Cassian had realized that setting his sniper rifle aside had roused a hunger in him. He tried to imagine executing another coldly elegant mission for Draven and finding nourishment in the stale, momentary thrills of danger and triumph. He couldn't survive that way anymore. After realizing that, recruiting the rest of the team had been easy. Jin was changing, and through her, Cassian would do what was required of him. They all would. Careful, you're starting to sound as zealous as Chirrut. The descent through Scanroff's atmosphere was so smooth as to be almost unnoticeable, save for the slow fading of the stars and the paling of the sky from black to blue. The ocean below, once Cassian could see it, seemed utterly still. Only the telltale ripples of light suggested waves. The shuttle hurtled over the specks of jungle-riddled volcanic islands and finally slowed as it approached a wheel of landmasses connected by sandy tombolos and transit tubes. Other shuttles and starfighters circled the islets, spiraling down or rising from the 24 landing pads supporting the wheel's sprawling Imperial installations. The layout was, so far as Cassian could tell, roughly as Bodia sketched out during the hyperspace journey. A voice came through the comm, bored and professional.
SW0608, clear for landing pad 9. Acknowledge, please.
SW0608 proceeding to LP9 as instructed, Bodhi said. The shuttle banked, dipping below the top of a monolithic Imperial fortress rising from the centermost islet. The main building down there, Cassian said. What is it? That's our goal, Bodhi said. The Citadel Tower. Command and control for this whole facility. Cassian was tempted to ask Bodhi to do a second flyby, but it wasn't worth the risk of drawing suspicion. Can you access the shield gate from inside?
Don't think so.
But if the Death Star plans are anywhere, they'll be there. They'd better be. They'd built their whole scheme around finding the Citadel's data vault. If by some chance Galen Erso had been wrong, if Bodhi was wrong now, if the Empire had moved the one data tape they needed to another location... Movement caught his eye atop the tower. The subtle readjustment of a massive signal array. And the dish at the top. What's it for? Bodhi shrugged.
That's the communications tower. Every communication, in and out of the space, goes through that dish.
Normal transmissions can't penetrate the shield, and a normal rig wouldn't have the bandwidth to handle everything on base at once. Cassian pictured the soldiers in the cabin below, scanned their faces and dossiers. He stopped at Corporal Pow. He had a vague recollection that the Spec Force Commando had taken out a similar comm unit in a demolitions job on Phorost. He made a note to ask him about it before leaving the shuttle.
"Landing track engaged,"
K2 said. Cassian stepped away from the viewport. He didn't expect anyone to spot him from the ground, but why take the chance?
"Security?"
he asked.
"How's it look right now?"
"I don't know," Bodhi said. "I've made 20 cargo runs in and out of the place. They've never let me off a landing pad, so I don't have much to compare it to. Security's tight."
Cassian watched green treetops and white beaches flash by. For an instant, he caught a glimpse of the boxy metallic body of an all-terrain armored cargo transport. A four-legged walker, whose militarized cousins he'd seen devastate bunkers. He'd almost never seen full-sized walkers outside a war zone.
"Well," he murmured, "we've faced longer odds."
"No,"
K2 said,
"we haven't."
There were almost 24 soldiers in the main cabin. 24 people waiting to fight and die. And all of them looked at Jin, like Saw's troops had looked at him. She'd listened to their chatter during the flight, caught a handful of names. Many of the troops had fought together before as Special Forces Pathfinders. Some had worked directly with Cassian, while he'd sought others based on their reputations. A few had caught wind of the Scarif operation and volunteered to come along instead of turning them all in. The rebels who didn't know one another rapidly swapped war stories or jokes or barbs, bonding the way soldiers did. Or they sat alone, staring contemplatively at their hands. Private Calfor was a half-deaf grenadier who'd once owned a bloodhound kennel on Mykapo. Escro Kasich was a braggart and a glory hound, and Jin pegged him instantly as a man terrified of being the mission's sole survivor. An unassuming middle-aged man with a thick accent had tasked himself with inspecting every blaster aboard, polishing away carbon buildup and swapping out energy packs. A pale woman had started shouting at one of her teammates about how the Alliance was dead, how they were all traitors now, and then sat back down mumbling apology after apology. Corporal Tonk had spent half the flight at Bodhi's side, skeptically questioning the pilot about his suitability for the operation. Whether Bodhi was competent with a blaster, whether he'd seen combat before, before grudgingly declaring he'd be the one to watch Bodhi's back. Almost no one spoke to Jin unless she spoke first. Saw had always been above his people, a symbol of the cause. Now Jin had been pushed into that role. With a pang, she realized how much she missed the camaraderie of Saw's cadre. Not the people, not their bitterness and fanaticism, but the unspoken knowledge that they were bound together under one man's leadership. She sat beside Baze and Chirrut as the shuttle descended. She had them now, but it wasn't quite the same. She jumped when a hand tapped her shoulder, and she turned to see a broad sniper looming over her. She tried to remember his name. Cephla.
"What is it?"
she asked.
"Small problem with the troops,"
Cephla said. Jin waited.
"They like you, ma'am, but if you want to give a speech, they'll have trouble respecting you. You're not military. You're not even Alliance."
"Not really my problem, is it?"
Jin said, more nonplussed than irritated.
"Hardly the right attitude, ma'am."
Cephla arched his brow.
"Morale is everyone's problem, so if Captain Andor won't do it, it falls to me, as an Alliance Spec Force Lieutenant, to brevet you the rank of Sergeant. Congratulations."
Cephla never smiled, but Chirrut was laughing silently.
"You're a cretin,"
Jin said.
"Yes, Sergeant," Cephla replied,
and walked back toward a cluster of Pathfinders.
Guess I'm giving a speech now, too,
Jin thought. She stood from her seat and began to pace.
Let them watch.
A short while later, Cassian clambered down the cockpit ladder.
We're landing,
he murmured to her, and then called to the group.
We're coming in!
A dozen soft conversations came to an immediate end. The soldiers rose, tightened the straps of their rifles, and secured their equipment for the final descent. After the clicking of metal and the rustling of leather stopped, all too swiftly for Jin's tastes, their eyes turned to her. She'd failed to rally the Alliance Council. She wasn't much of a speaker. Fighting was all she knew. Maybe this was her perfect audience. She began, raising her voice above the rattle of the deck plating.
Saw Gerrera used to say, one fighter with a sharp stick and nothing left to lose can take the day.
No one heckled her. No one asked questions. A few Spec Force officers nodded.
They have no idea we're coming. They have no reason to expect us. If we can make it to the ground, we'll take the next chance. And the next. On and on until we win, or the chances are spent. The Death Star plans are down there. Cassian, K2, and I will find them. We'll find a way to find them.
There was no applause either, yet the soldiers looked proud and ready. She could have promised them their lives. She could have promised a great victory for the Alliance, but this was all she could offer, and she hoped it was enough. Cassian stepped forward before anyone's attention could drift.
Melshi, Pau, Baze, Chirrut. You'll take main squad, move east, and get wide of the ship. Find a position between here and the tower. Once you get to the best spot, light the place up. Make 10 men feel like 100. And get those troopers away from us.
What should I do?
The call came from Bodhi, climbing down from the cockpit and leaving K2 behind.
Keep the engine running,
Cassian said.
You're our only way out of here. Assuming we make it back,
Jin thought. She might have said it aloud, but she was sure they were all thinking it anyway. Chapter 16. The cargo inspection went as well as Jin could have hoped. The shuttle hadn't been built to carry 2 dozen armed rebels laden with gear, let alone conceal them for a curious Imperial security team. But the inspection, Bodhi had assured them, was unavoidable. All they could do was try to take advantage of it. So Jin had secreted herself in the cockpit, squeezed in tight between Cassian's shoulder, smelling of blaster oil and Edu's dirt, and the main console. She listened to the boarding ramp descend, heard booted feet against the metal deck, and Bodhi making quick, awkward introductions in the main cabin. She listened to the murmurs of the inspection team. She listened for the sound of 2 dozen men and women crammed into cargo stores and crawl spaces like refugees.
Hey, you're probably looking for a manifest, Bodhi said,
sounding less convincing all the time.
That would be helpful.
Another voice, curt and officious.
It's just down here.
Jin wrapped her fingers around her blaster's grip. She could spring out of the cockpit in one leap if she had to. Maybe even land at the base of the ladder without breaking her legs. She heard the creak of a cargo hatch swinging open. There was one brief, muffled cry, and then the sound of multiple impacts against the deck. No shots fired. She scrambled forward, fumbled her way down the ladder in time to see Baze emerging from the cargo compartment with a terrifying smile. Bodhi stood wide-eyed among the bodies of the inspection team.
Off to a good start,
Jin said, as the rest of the rebels emerged. 3 minutes later, she had managed to fit a too large Imperial security uniform over her clothes. The black chest plate looked too large on her, and the sleeves felt too long over her gloves, but it would have to suffice. She almost winced when she looked at Cassian wearing an officer's suit and cap like they were perfectly tailored. Even the code cylinder in his pocket was at a regulation angle.
You've done this before,
she murmured, and he ignored her. The rest of the soldiers were stowing the bodies and passing around stripped weapons and comlinks. She checked her blaster one final time, strapped on her helmet, and looked to the boarding ramp. Melshi made what she took as a ready signal from a cluster of soldiers. She started to move toward Cassian and the exit before she felt a great shadow at her side. Baze, with a touch as light as a windblown leaf, touched her shoulder.
"Good luck, little sister," he said.
He spoke with warmth and gravity, as if the words were a Jedi custom or in honor of the guardians of the wills. Jin didn't know. She didn't have to know. She smiled at him, searched for words, and found none. She hoped he understood her gratitude. Cassian waited for her at the ramp. Together, in the garb of the enemy, they stepped out onto Scarif. Scarif was bright as a desert, bright as her cave was now. Jin could taste salt water in the air. The warmth of the sun might have been unbearable under her black uniform if the breeze hadn't been in constant motion, swelling and ebbing as if jealous of the tides. She tried not to look at the shuttles thundering overhead, to keep her chin up and her eyes forward like a proper guard. She wasn't sure how well she managed the act. Twice she had to slow her pace to allow Cassian, her superior officer, to take the lead. K2SO trailed them both, servos whirring with every step. They marched down off the shuttle pad, cramped with consoles and cargo crates and power stations. From there, they followed a short trail to an above-ground bunker linked to the repulsor rail system that would lead to the Citadel. Jin blinked away the sunlight and a sudden, distant drowsiness.
"Sir!"
As they reached the terminal, a guard tapped a button and the doors of a car slid open, admitting Cassian, Jin, and K2.
"Stay focused, Jin."
"Our odds of failure have gone up,"
K2 said.
"I have a bad feeling about..."
"K,"
Cassian hissed.
"Quiet,"
Jin added. The doors closed in time to deny entry to a pair of stormtroopers. Jin shook her head briskly and shifted her weight as the car hummed into motion.
"What?"
K2 asked. Neither she nor Cassian answered.
"Focus,"
Jin told herself again, even as she shifted her weight back and forth, found no outlet for either her nervous energy or the tension building in her mind. She thought of Baze's smile, of her promotion by Lieutenant Cephla, of what her comrades were preparing to do outside.
"What is it?"
Cassian asked. His voice was low, and sun and shadows danced across his features as the car raced over the water. Jin waved a hand dismissively, but he only asked again, more sternly,
"What is it?"
She twisted and peered through the window. The Citadel Tower was growing larger, dark against the shining sky.
"Just what I told them all back there, about what Saw Gerrera said."
"What about it?" Cassian asked. She tugged awkwardly at one glove's fingers.
"We never fought like this with him. I never did. With Saw, missions were usually about hitting the Empire hard, hitting back for revenge, slowly bleeding them to death. And what we're doing now is different."
Cassian was being careful, showing nothing of his thoughts.
"Yes,"
Jin said.
"If we don't win this, people out there,"
she waved at the unseen stars,
"don't just ignore it. We have to get those plans. I'm not sure I know how to fight to accomplish something."
All of it was true. None of it was what troubled Jin most. None of it was what she wanted to hide from herself, now that she'd seen the truth.
"You're going to do fine,"
Cassian said, and he was trying, speaking with a gentleness and compassion Jin had barely seen echoes of, but it wasn't the answer she needed. She would fight to find the plans. She would trust Cassian and Chirrut and Baze and Bodhi and Melshi and all the others to push her down the course she needed to go. But if the mission began to go wrong, what then? If she lost them in the chaos,
She'd fought all her life. But even in Saw's cadre, she'd fought more than anything, more than for vengeance or ferocity, for her own survival. If she fell back on old instincts, what then? She could risk herself for a person, wrestle an innocent girl out of the crossfire. But if she found herself alone, she didn't know if she could risk herself for the cause. We're slowing down, Cassian said. Just focus, Jin. The railcar's hum changed in pitch, and the dancing shadows relaxed their frenzy. We need a map. Cassian went on. This place is too big, and we're too vulnerable to wander around looking for the vault. K2 swiveled his head, but didn't look toward Cassian.
I'm sure there's one just lying about.
You know what you have to do, Cassian answered. Jin frowned. Before she could ask what Cassian meant, the railcar doors were sliding open. They emerged into the Scarif Citadel, where the light that had permeated the outdoors was gone, replaced by rows of illumination strips embedded in dark metal walls. Corridors branched off from the rail station, and officers, guards, and the occasional stormtrooper moved at an unhurried pace down the line. Cassian was right. Without a map, they were helpless. Jin tugged at her uniform, which felt more ill-fitting than ever. A security droid, identical to K2SO, strolled past. Cassian nodded toward K2, and they started a leisurely pursuit. Jin forced herself not to reach for her weapon, reminded herself to stay calm. If they'd been detected, an alarm would have gone out. If the others had been detected, the whole complex would have been in a frenzy. They tracked the droid down a long corridor. When it ducked into a terminal alcove lined with machinery, Cassian stationed himself against the wall to one side. Jin took the other side and watched K2 follow his twin. With a single motion, K2 reached out with a fist, ejected a retractable data spike from his wrist joint, and plunged it into the back of his twin's metal head. The second droid let out a garbled electronic wail that lasted no more than half a second. Then he dropped to his knees as K2 stood over him, maintaining the connection.
Do it fast,
Cassian urged. He stepped in front of the alcove, still watching down the corridor, as if his body could block a view of the two towering droids. Jin joined him, glancing between her end of the corridor and K2. The droid's head was swinging on his neck, back and forth like a weather vane.
Is he all right?
Jin asked.
KX series droids are hardened against intrusion,
Cassian said brusquely.
Getting past their programming is a challenge.
After nearly a minute, he asked, K2SO lifted his head and extracted his data spike from his twin.
Our optimal route to the data vault places only 89 stormtroopers in our path. We will make it one-third of the way before we are killed.
The second droid limply tumbled to the floor.
All right,
Jin said. Let's hope everyone's in position.
Baze Malbus neither knew nor trusted the rebel soldiers around him. He did not respect their loyalties. He could not rely upon their skills. He would fight alongside them because Jin Erso had accepted them into her own revolution. Not the revolution of the Alliance, but one that had risen from the ashes of the Holy City to bring retribution where resurrection was impossible. He trusted Jin's fury and her fire. Most of all, though he was loath to admit it, he trusted Jin because of Chirrut Imwe. Those whom Chirrut trusted, Baze could find a reason to trust as well. Life was more convenient that way. Even Baze found eternal weariness exhausting.
Go! Bodhi cried from the cockpit of the cargo shuttle. Now! You're clear!
Together the soldiers poured onto the landing pad. Baze kept his cannon up and walked in Chirrut's shadow, letting the blind man choose their pace and sweep the ground with his staff. They followed the rebels off the platform and between the broad-leafed trees of the jungle, away from the eyes of stormtrooper patrols and starfighters. Five soldiers had remained aboard the shuttle to protect the extraction point and Bodhi Rook.
In another life, Baze might have prayed for the pilot. In this life, Baze knew that Bodhi would live or die according to skill and chance, more likely the latter than the former. One of the rebels, a clean-shaven spotter, fell back to Baze's side.
"Can he keep up?"
he asked softly, nodding toward Shirat. Baze snorted and didn't bother turning toward the spotter.
"Hide your trail better. Then he can keep up."
He flicked a finger at the white sand and Chirrut's feet. Where Chirrut tapped at the ground with his staff, he flung the sand aside and half-covered the soldier's tracks. Where the skirts of his robes trailed, they occluded what markings remained.
"He can hear you!"
Chirrut snapped. The spotter nodded briskly. Chagrined, he offered Chirrut a crisp, "Sorry, sir," and shuffled toward the fore. Baze noted that this time, the rebel took care to obscure his footprints.
"At least he didn't ask if you were a Jedi,"
Baze muttered. But Chirrut had begun chanting, "May the force of others be with you." They wound their way deeper into the jungle, the vivid green canopy never thick enough to obscure the sun. As sand began to give way to richer soil, Baze knelt and, mid-stride, swept up a few pale grains between thumb and forefinger. He raised the pinch of sand to his nose. It smelled of sea salt and loam. He touched the grains to his tongue and spat them out.
"Even the dirt tastes different," he thought.
Dirt was all that was left of Jeddah. But he did not think he would ever return there.
Scarif, with its trees, the gaudy emerald of cantina lights, with its tepid oceans and sand like crushed bones, was as much his home now as anywhere. "The city is gone, old man. Nijeda is gone."
He reached an arm behind him, clasped the exhaust vent on his portable generator. In the warmth of Scarif, he would need to mind how he strained his cannon. It wouldn't do to quit shooting at the wrong moment. The soldiers drew to a halt near a low hillock. Sergeant Melshi, who commanded the team, peered over the crest with a set of quadnocks. Baze squinted through the sun and saw a squat imperial structure and two squads of stormtroopers across the way.
"Barracks,"
he murmured, and Chirrut nodded in acknowledgement. Melshi scrambled to the base of the hillock and signaled one of his subordinates. The second man walked among the rebels briskly but deliberately handing out magnetized detonators.
"This is as far as we get,"
Melshi said.
"Fan out. One detonator per landing pad. You see a better target, take it. But there's no resupplying, so pick your spots."
The rebel carrying the detonators held out one each to Baze and Chirrut. Baze shook his head and the boy moved on. Melshi was still talking.
"We want to draw them out. So keep moving once we start and don't let them pull back to the bunkers. I'll call the timing."
He scanned the group and nodded sharply.
"Go!"
The rebels scattered in ones, twos, and threes. Melshi looked to Baze and Chirrut.
"You too good for demolitions duty?"
His tone was good-humored but puzzled.
"Someone must keep your soldiers alive,"
Baze said. He smiled, showing teeth. Melshi appeared unamused.
"Well?"
Baze asked, flapping a hand at Chirrut. Chirrut's lips were moving. When he finished his chant, "The Force is with me, and I am with the Force," the Guardian strode after one pack of rebels.
"We won't be long,"
Chirrut said, and looked back to cast a blind glance at Melshi. As Chirrut followed the rebel soldiers, Baze followed Chirrut. Together, they hunted. Among the stormtroopers who roamed the dirt paths and landing pads and bunkers were many dressed in specialized armor the color of rotting teeth. The uniform was evidently lightweight and flexible, appropriate to heat and to wading along the beaches. Vulnerable, Baze thought, to hard, swift strikes that broke legs and necks. Chirrut downed the first two stormtroopers of the day, sweeping them off their feet before they could complete their patrol around a landing pad and catch a glimpse of the rebel spotter planting his detonator. Baze claimed another trooper soon after,
bursting out of the vegetation to wrap his hands around a neck encased in a black bodysuit. He dug his fingers beneath the rim of the struggling stormtrooper's helmet as he dragged the man back between the trees and denied him air until the helmet tumbled off and Baze could slam his face against a rock. The stormtrooper did not move again. They hunted in sync. Chirrut always prowling near the rebels, and Baze always prowling near Chirrut. Baze did not limit his targets to those who might spot the blind man, but he kept Chirrut under observation nonetheless. Where the force would fail Chirrut, Baze would not. His hands and arms quickly grew sore. Baze was strong, but he was aging, and he didn't have the luxury of using his cannon. He mopped his brow with his sleeve and took a swallow from his canteen as the rebels regrouped near Melshi, now closer to the barracks than ever. Chirrut crouched between trees, a dozen meters away. The soldiers looked anxious. They looked resolved. They watched the barracks and their surroundings, their rifles ready as they lay prone in the sand and pressed tight against trees for camouflage. Maybe, Baze thought, he could trust them after all. He heard Melshi's voice over his comlink.
Ready, ready. Standing by.
He listened to the hiss of sea foam spilling over sand and the faraway howl of shuttles. Eventually, Cassian's response came over the comm.
Light it up.
Director Krennic, we are entering the Scare of Shieldgate. General Ramda has been informed of your arrival. Orson Krennic grunted in acknowledgement and touched a forefinger to his throat, worrying at the soreness and the bruising. Darth Vader's assault would take a day or more to heal. In the meantime, a lingering ache brought Krennic a reminder of the precariousness of his position. He stood at a metaphorical cliff's edge, stamping his foot in an effort to cause an avalanche. With Galen Erso's treachery undone, he would gain the allegiance of Vader. With Vader's backing, he would expose the incompetence of Tarkin, the revelation of rebel survivors from Jedha. With Tarkin humiliated, Krennic's command of the Death Star would be uncontested, and he would confer with the Emperor himself as to how it might best be used. Krennic would be, in every way that mattered, the most powerful and decorated man in the Empire. Or he would fall from the cliff and bash his skull open on the rocks. And his Death Star would fall into the fumbling hands of Willif Tarkin. Tarkin, Erso, Vader. How had so many men conspired against him for so long?
Beginning final descent now, the pilot's voice called.
Sulk like a child another day. Solve your Erso problem first.
He disembarked with his escort of death troopers, waved a brusque acknowledgement at the lieutenant who'd come to guide him off the Citadel's executive landing pad, and ignored the seductive caress of the warm Scarif air. Galen had possessed nearly unrestricted access to the Citadel. Under the supervision of Imperial minders, yes, but Scarif's overseers lacked rigor, earning their assignments on the tropical world largely through cronyism. They trusted to the stormtrooper garrison, the planetary shield, and the star destroyers in orbit. They relied too much on the Citadel's automated security measures. The damage Galen could have done was considerable. Krennic overtook his guide as he disembarked the turbolift and made for the Citadel command center. General Ramda and his people were awaiting at attention as Krennic descended into the control pit.
Director, Ramda declared, what brings you to Scarif?
Krennic bristled at the voice, at the tone of a man who prepared a facility tour and an official dinner, instead of foreseeing the crisis at hand. Ramda was another officer whose incompetence exceeded his vision.
Galen Erso, Krennic snapped. I want every dispatch, every transmission he's ever sent, called up for inspection.
I'll put three men on it immediately.
Ramda hid his confusion poorly as Krennic brushed past him, heading for a console.
What are they looking for?
Krennic stopped, pivoted, and stared at the general with curdled disgust.
I'm inspecting them myself. That's why I'm here.
Everyone?
Yes, all of them. Get started.
Maybe, Krennic thought, he'd managed to overestimate Ramda's competence. Maybe he'd accepted too much responsibility himself for Galen's treachery. Not that shifting the blame, no matter the justification, would mollify Vader. He had a plan for the task ahead. He would start by checking any outsized transmissions. In all likelihood, Galen hadn't dared to broadcast complete files from the data vault. Even Scarif's lack of security should have detected that, but it was best to be sure. After that, Krennic could look for the names of anyone inside the Empire Galen might have drawn into a conspiracy. The Galen Krennic knew lacked the charisma to win allies and the guts to attempt blackmail. But the Galen Krennic knew wouldn't have abandoned his life's work in the first place. He took a seat at a duty station by the windows as officers shuffled nervously behind him. Once he was through with the obvious possibilities, he'd need to start culling through messages by hand. He'd need to look for code words for anything off-kilter. Galen knew too much, had seen too much. If he'd sent the rebels intelligence on Imperial defenses, on hyperspace routes, it could leave more than one planet vulnerable to a well-coordinated attack. If he'd authorized shipments of equipment or weaponry, he might have supplied his allies somehow. But if he'd sent information about the Death Star just a little at a time, forgetting to properly encrypt the data so that the rebellion could eavesdrop, then what? What could the Rebel Alliance do? There was no defense against the battle station. You'll never win. The brief bass rumble that interrupted Krennic's thoughts seemed to him an irritation. Another failure on the part of Ramda and his men to provide him with what he needed. But then, another rumble followed, and others swiftly in sequence. Krennic snapped to a stand, stared out onto the Scarif landscape as smoke and fire rippled up from a dozen points out of the green. The officers were yammering behind him. He heard no words, but recognized a shared tone of surprise and confusion. Were they truly so oblivious?
"Are we blind?" he shouted, spinning to face the command center and ignoring the roughness in his throat. "The rebels are here!"
He had the attention of the room. Attention was not what he required.
"Deploy the garrison!"
he screamed.
"Move!"
And they did move at last. Ramda barking orders and his subordinates pulling up aerial maps and holograms. Ramda was ignorant, of course, of the enemy's true objective, but Krennic knew this was Galen's work. One more consequence of his sabotage, of his secret messages. Krennic cursed the man before seeking to put the news into context. Rebels, almost certainly rebels, were attempting to reach the data vault. They were attempting to steal the schematics for the battle station.
Why? To build their own. To search for a weakness. There was no weakness. Even the possibility was unacceptable.
And another thought crawled through the back of Krennic's brain. A thought that should not have frightened him. One that meant nothing at this juncture. Had no implications for the reality on the ground. But which made his clenched fist tremble nonetheless. The survivors of Jedha had struck on Edu. And he had seen one of them there on the platform as the bombs fell, though he could not remember his enemy's face. From Edu, they had followed him to Scarif. He vowed not to let them escape a third time.
Chapter 17. Yavin 4 was a prison world. It seemed discourteous to say so aloud. Base 1 had given Mon Mothma a home, a shelter from an empire that would have eagerly chased her into the wilds of the galaxy for the slimmest chance of executing her. But leaving Yavin was next to impossible for those same reasons. Mon's travels off-world were rare and short-lived, and they always ended back in her cell within the ziggurat. She was chief of state of the Rebel Alliance, and her power
extended as far as the tree line of the jungle. She fought a fierce envy as the counselors she'd summoned piled into their starships, soared one by one into the bright blue sky.